Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. For those who are familiar with the show, here is Theophilus. He just decided to be insane, of course, because we just pushed record, so that means he's going to be nuts. Hopefully he will not be eating into my books, but this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature and life. Man, I love thinking about cool stuff. So you guys are invited to come think with me. Today's a very special guest. I have with me Dr. Samuel Liebens. And man, we're going to be talking about whether or not you exist in the mind of God and whether or not you're like a fictional character in his mind. It's going to be awesome. I'm really, really excited for it. If you guys like this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can become a YouTube member. And YouTube members and patrons get early access to all the episodes, as well as a bunch of other perks and merch and stuff like that. So you can find the links in the description. If you're on YouTube, you can see the join thing. Just go ahead and give that a click. A lot of ways to support the podcast. So please consider doing so if you want me to keep feeding my crazy dog and keep these lights on. So without further ado, let's bring in Sam and let's talk about God's mind. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man. This is really exciting.
Great pleasure. It's nice to be here. How you doing?
Doing well. Now that I got you here, so you're in a different place in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're at and what you're doing out there?
Sure. So I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of Haifa in the north of Israel. I was born and raised in England. But it was always an ambition of mine and my family's, my ancestors, of course, to come back to Israel from where we hailed. It was a long time in exile. So luckily, I managed to get a job in the University of Haifa. I'd spent some time in America before that. I was at Rutgers in the Center for Philosophy of Religion there, and I was at Notre Dame at the Center for Philosophy of Religion there. But I grew up in England. I'm from the town of Leicester. For those of your listeners or viewers who follow soccer, as they call it on your side of the Atlantic,
that's right.
We call it football. That's it. So in the north of Israel is where I make my home.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Leicester because I was gonna ask about your accent. I'm trying to get like good at picking out because I get all these English guests on, and you all sound different. Everyone sounds different. Yeah. Yours is like an elegant. You got a real nice one. I don't know where it is. Is that northern England?
Leicester is right in the middle of England.
Okay.
So it's I think some people in Leicester do have a northern accent, but mine is quite generic. English accent. But it's crazy. It's a tiny country, England, and yet the number of accents in that country and in the United Kingdom in general is very small. It's like United Kingdom is much smaller than Texas. Let's say. It's got dozens, if not hundreds, of accents. Crazy.
Seriously. Yeah. So crazy. Well, before we jump in on some of your papers here, I just wanted to get a feel for how did you get into philosophy? And then, what made you want to become a professional philosopher?
Sure. Well, I got into philosophy at high school. Mm. When I was 16 in British high school, you have to specialize in a few topics. It's like taking APs, advanced papers in America, but that's all you do in high school for the last 2 years in Britain. And you have to choose a number of topics. And in fact, that's why things like law and medicine in America are postgrad degrees. In Britain, they're undergraduate degrees. And you have to choose at high school already, to do pre-med at high school. That's
big crazy. Decision. Yeah, seriously, it's big decisions.
I had no clue what I wanted to do. So I chose things I thought I was good at. I chose theater, English literature, and politics. And I needed a fourth, and I wanted to do music. But my parents said, you can't do drama and music. You need to do they wanted more academic, So one of the teachers from the religious studies department at high school pulled me aside and was like, Sam, you've got to take our A-level in philosophy. It's amazing. And I really didn't enjoy religious studies at high school. And I was like, no, I don't want to do it. But he practically begged me. He said, you're really going to like this. I promise you. So I decided to take it just to see what it was like. And it really changed my life. I actually, I recently wrote an introduction to philosophy of religion. It's called Philosophy of Religion, The Basics. It's part of a series with Routledge. And I dedicated it to my two philosophy A-level teachers. Like, wow. I said, you know, I didn't, you know. And then you said, how do I become a professional philosopher? Well, I did my bachelor's degree. And I just felt like I hadn't exhausted the itch that I was trying to scratch with my philosophy degree.
Yeah.
I'll do a master's. And then I finished the PhD, the master's PhD, and I just wasn't finished, scratching that itch. And yeah. there wasn't a moment where I said, okay, I'm going to become a professional philosopher. It just, I just never gave up studying it. And there was rabbinic stuff on the side as well. I went to rabbinical school as well. I became religious as about the same time as I found philosophy, actually, but it wasn't as related in my life as it became. The religion stuff was was more based on emotions, whereas the philosophy was more based on reason, and it took a while for me to kind of marry the two. One second, there's a noise in the background. Can you hear that? Is that okay?
Just a little bit. It's totally fine. Yeah.
Okay. So I what was I saying? Yeah.
Religious.
Yeah. So I became religious about the same time. And I actually, before I did my bachelor's degree, I did 2 years in rabbinical school. Mm-hmm. And actually at the rabbinical school, and I'm sure it's the same in some Christian circles, they were not keen on me doing philosophy. They thought, you'll go to university, you'll study philosophy, you'll lose your faith.
100%.
Didn't happen to me, thank God. Yeah. And then after my PhD, I went back to rabbinical school, and I actually became an ordained rabbi.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. Is that Orthodox? You're an Orthodox rabbi, right?
I'm an Orthodox rabbi, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm a very unorthodox Orthodox rabbi, but officially I'm an Orthodox rabbi.
Yeah. I've been enjoying some of your works on that. You wrote a piece like critiquing Ben Shapiro. I thought that was a good one.
That's right.
Fun stuff. So today we're going to get into Hasidic idealism and... Mm-hmm. Looking over the sources and stuff like that, I'm like, usually I have a way in and I can, I know this author. And this one was like, nope, I don't know. So I need a lot of help. And it was really good. Hasidic, can you help us with like the difference between like Hasidic and Orthodox? Is there a difference between those types of Judaism?
Yes and no. Orthodoxy is like a broad description of lots of different strands, or lots of different types of orthodoxy. I suppose it's like, you know, you could call yourself Protestant, but then there's loads of different strands of Protestantism. Even within like a more united church, like the Catholic Church, you could call yourself Catholic, but then even within Catholic, you know, there are different sects or different
Augustinian.
And then you could be in different, if you're you're different orders, right? Monastic orders. Mm-hmm. You could be Dominican and Franciscan or whatever. I would say that the orthodoxy is like one very broad communion. I'm trying to translate into kind of Christian terms.
This is good. This is helpful.
Right. And then there are lots of different strands within that very broad communion. One strand is ultra orthodoxy, which takes a very negative attitude towards non-Jewish wisdom, the secular world. They're quite introverted, a bit like the Amish okay, that's the ultra orthodox.
This is good. I'm so glad you can help with all the connections, man. This is gold.
Because I spent quite a lot of time with a lot of Christian theologians and philosophers, so I've kind of learned. Hasidism was a pietistic movement in the 1700s within Orthodoxy. And now the intellectual descendants of Hasidism are one strand of ultra-Orthodoxy. today. Now, I'm not a Hasidic Jew, and I'm not an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I'm what's called a modern Orthodox Jew, which is a type of orthodoxy that embraces secular wisdom, and non-Jewish wisdom, as well as Torah wisdom and revealed wisdom. But I have never believed that Hasidic wisdom is only for members of the Hasidic sects, right? There's a lot of wisdom there, for all of us, Jew and non-Jew, to reflect.
Okay, that's fantastic. So another one would be, I already lost it. You told me how to say it, but I think it's Kabbalistic Judaism.
Yeah, Kabbalah, right? So there's Kabbalistic Judaism, right? So Kabbalah is the main strand of Jewish mystical thinking. And there are Kabbalistic Jews. You know, Hasidism was pretty much exclusively Kabbalistic, but there were non-Hasidic Jews who were Kabbalists as well. Hasidism tended to be an Eastern European phenomenon, whereas the Kabbalah was much wider, geographically. Jews in North Africa, Jews in the lands associated with Islam, as well as Jews in Europe were interested in the Kabbalah.
Was the Kabbalah and Kabbalistic Judaism, was that more like mystical, and then Hasidic was more like intellectual? Is that a way to categorize them, or not necessarily?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism. So all Kabbalists are mystical. There were non-Kabbalistic Jews like Maimonides, the Jewish rationalists. And there you could make that distinction.
Okay.
But also Hasidism was anti-elitist. So you're right that Hasidism was emotional, pietistic, but non-elitist. It was supposed to be for the everyday Jew. Whereas non-Hasidic forms of Judaism, be they Kabbalistic or not Kabbalistic, they'd become quite elitist and quite, intellectualist.
Yeah.
And if you weren't smart enough, you kind of didn't matter, God forbid. Whereas Hasidism was about rejecting that elitism.
Okay.
Everybody can have a relationship with God. You don't have to be smart.
Yeah. Oh man, this is good. And there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap in Christendom as well with those type of things. Man, that's fascinating. So you got this paper that we're going to be talking about, where you're trying to help solve this problem of of Sephra and Sephirot.
The Sephirot. The Sephirot is the plural. Sephirot.
So you're solving this problem. Fun. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. This is like way out of my element, but I'm loving it. There's this apparent problem where it looks like, it looks like there's different like aspects of God, in one way, or maybe even like different personalities, almost like different things in God are personified, like his justice and stuff. Can you help us? Like, can you lay out Sephirot more?
Sephirot.
Motivate the problem for us.
No worries. Sephirot is the plural of the word Sephira. So there are 10 of these things. Each one of them is a Sephira, and in plural they're the Sephirot. What are they? Well, it's part of the Kabbalistic tradition, and non-Kabbalistic Jews don't believe in this at all. They don't think there is such a thing as the Sephirot. There's just God. The Kabbalistic Jews, be they Hasidic or non-Hasidic, doesn't matter. Kabbalistic Jews have tended to relate to God as this singular being who, in his transcendence, so to speak, before he even created the world, he was completely unified and undifferentiated, almost to such an extent that language fails systematically to describe this being, God in his transcendence, because the way that language seems to work, it has this deep grammar. Predicates and subjects. Every sentence kind of has the noun phrase, which is what the sentence is about, and then the predicate, which describes the noun phrase. And the idea is that God in his transcendent is so unified and also so kind of self-sufficient, and there's such an undifferentiated perfection that as soon as you try to describe God, you start imposing distinctions that where there really shouldn't be distinctions, even if it's just distinctions of grammar. So the idea is God in his transcendence, completely and utterly singular. But as God becomes manifest in the world that he creates, it's as if the pure light of God's divinity, and I know this Gregory Palamas, is that his name, in the Eastern tradition, that in Eastern Christian Orthodoxy, I think there's a similar thought in Eastern Orthodoxy in Christendom. There's this idea that God's light, as it comes into the world, is kind of refracted into different, like the white light of the sun becomes refracted into the many colors of the rainbow, right? Yeah. God, as he, so to speak, unfolds into his own creation, he refracts into these 10 kind of attributes, mm-hmm. and that's what we call the spherot, these 10 attributes. Now, the problem is, in the mystical tradition, you ask me what the problem is. Yeah. The mystical tradition relates to these 10 attributes, which it sees sourced in the, hinted to in the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible never, as you'll know, because it's the Old Testament of your Bible, yeah. Parker, right. But it never refers to these things by name as there being 10 of these things, although there's an odd verse here or there that the Kabbalists appropriate or recruit as hinting to these 10 attributes. But as the Kabbalistic tradition develops, they start to relate to them as powers, like 10 powers. Yeah. They even start to relate to them as interacting with one another. So one of them is called mercy, right? And one of them is called justice. And those two are in tension with one another. And you can kind of imagine, like, God, From the aspect of justice, God forbid, might want to punish us for our sins, but from the aspect of mercy, might want to forgive us.
Yeah.
And as this unfolds into the world, these two, so to speak, entities, justice and mercy, are in conflict with one another. And some of them are male and some of them are female. Some of them even have erotic relations and give birth to new spherot. So along came the anti-Kabbalistic Jews, and they said, where are you getting this from? First of all, it's not in the Bible, right? It's just not in the Bible. It's not even in the early rabbinic traditions, or if it is, it's deeply hidden, right? The Kabbalistic masters, they could find hints in earlier rabbinic texts, but it's certainly not explicit in the Bible. So first of all, where are you getting this from? Second of all, we are monotheists, right? And we think that God is one. And you've kind of made him like he's 10. And they'd say all these strange things. Well, that God is 10, but he's also one, right? Mm. And they're like, you know, are these things identical to each other? Because if they're one, they must be identical to each other. Or are they distinct entities? Because if they're fighting or making love, right, they must be distinct entities. But if they're all God, they must be identical entities. If you pray to them, is that idolatry? Because you're not actually praying to God. I know that in some parts of Christendom, praying to saints or praying to people other than God is acceptable. And in other parts of Christendom, that's completely forbidden. But in the Jewish tradition, it's almost exclusive. You can't pray to anything other than God. And yet the mystics seem to pray to these things. Well, you know, so you can start to see the problems. And I think for a Christian, it's not identical for reasons we might get to, Parker, but it's very similar to problems related to the Trinity, right? Because along comes the early church based on hints, perhaps, in the New Testament. Some people may think it's more than hints. Other people may think it's just hints. But based on hints in the New Testament, that you'd find much harder to justify in the Old Testament. But again, maybe you could see hints here and there. But, you know, but along comes the early church and says, look, God is three persons. It's one God, three persons. And the Unitarians, and I don't mean the Unitarian Universal Church in America that's barely theistic. I mean the hardcore Unitarians, like the real, you know.
They usually call themselves biblical. We're biblical Unitarians. You're like, all right, biblical, we're all trying Unitarian. To be biblical. But yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, but people like Dale Tuggy, right? Yeah, I don't know if you come across Dale's work.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
But also, Muslims and Muslims and Jews, you know, outside of the Kabbalistic tradition, we're Unitarians. God is one. And what are you telling me? That three persons, they're identical to each other, but they're not identical to each other, but they're one, but they're three. It just sounds like a complete headache. And the the anti-Kabbalistic Jews said similar things against the Kabbalah because of this, what I'm calling the problem with the Sfirot. And to such an extent that in one famous medieval letter, an anti-Kabbalistic rabbi, Rabbi Shimon Duran, says, you know, you think Christianity has trouble, but they've only got three. You guys have got 10. So you know, I'm certainly not the first to draw this analogy between the problem of the Sfirot and related problems with Trinitarian thinking.
Yeah, I love that. As I saw it, I was like, okay, boom, yes, we got the same kind of thing going on here. This is so good. So if a lot of my audience will know that, like, if you read a book on divine simplicity, it has to have the prism on the cover. It has to, the white light coming in. And but usually they will emphasize these are not real distinctions. You know, it's just through the prism of creation type stuff. Yeah. With with Kabbalism, is it clear whether there's like a general teaching, like these are distinct things, or, you know, is there even infighting within the truth? And it's just kind of,
look, it's not clear. There's a lot of infighting and there's a lot of confusion. I just have to be completely brutally honest with you.
Sure.
The early sources seem to mix their metaphors all the time. So sometimes they make it sound like these 10 Sfirot instruments that God uses. And sometimes they're described as attributes of God. Sometimes they're described as like independent entities. Sometimes they're described merely as refracted light. And some of these mystical authors, you know, mix those metaphors and use them all. And you're like, oh no, I'm trying to get my head straight. It's a philosopher. It's a real pain. And one thing that differentiates Jewish orthodoxy, I think, from any kind of Christian denomination is that we never had councils, right? Mm. So in Christian theology, there are going to be these early councils, church councils. Different churches, of course, will disagree as to which ones are the authoritative and which ones do you have to listen to and which ones, you know, but we never had anything of the sort. So really what unifies our communion, so to speak, is practical. We all see ourselves bound by Jewish law, and there's a very intricate Jewish legal system. But on matters of fine-grained theology, we never had a council to say, okay, now we're going to decide. These guys are right, those guys are wrong. And so our traditions just got like lots of different suggestions, right? And I'm just a lonely guy trying to make sense of them all.
Well, I kind of like that, because it's like we disagree on some stuff, but I am not going to call you a heretic, you know, like, or maybe you could joke with each other a little bit more this council said that. And like, well, what if we come to learn something different than what the council said? What if our metaphysics are different? It's like, nope, it's gotta be Aristotelian.
We do have more freedom and a certain degree more tolerance. Don't get me wrong. There have been terrible times where Jews have written other Jews off for being heretics and burnt their books. But in theory, and you do see it even in practice, Jews with very different theologies will go to the same synagogue and pray together.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had a question about the Sfirot. Can you say it again for me? I want to try and say it right.
So we'll talk about them in the plural. So it's the Sfirot.
Sfirot. Okay. Boom.
Yeah.
Sfirot. So like if you read a commentary on like the book of John, the Gospel of John, D.A. Carson, one of my professors, he would emphasize Debar in the Old Testament, and you know, God spoke by his word, and it's almost as if the word is being personified. And that was kind of my hook to get into the Sfirot and be like, "Oh, I'm seeing some of this." But Can you tell us some more? Like, you don't have to name all 10, but is the word one of them or not?
That's
really?
That's a very nice point, Parker. No, maybe the word is one of them. There are three intellectual Sfirot, right?
Okay.
Most of them are more like emotional. Three of them are kind of intellectual: Chochmah, Binah, and Dat, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge.
Oh, cool.
And there are some people who identify Chochmah, which is wisdom, with Torah, with Scripture, the Old Testament, and they associate that with the Word, right? So what's happening in John is there's a reference there to the wisdom in the book of Proverbs chapter 8, right? Yep. There was the wisdom that existed before the world was created, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, in the Kabbalistic system, many people would identify the first of the Sfirot, called Chochmah, with that wisdom that existed before the world was created. And that's likely what John was talking about.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
In the Christian tradition, that becomes flesh in Jesus.
Yeah.
In the Jewish tradition, that becomes, so to speak, flesh in the scripture of the five books of Moses.
Yeah.
Right? The five books of Moses is something like an incarnation of that first Sefirah. And in fact, I mean, I'm not here to teach you Christianity, but in fact, that's one way of understanding what Jesus is saying. He's saying when he comes to embody the law of Moses, he's being quite literal, right? That the law of Moses was the first incarnation of that davar, of that word, but perhaps it was unduly abstract and the people didn't understand what they were supposed to understand from it. So it becomes incarnate in actual flesh. In Jesus. Now, I'm not a Christian. I'm not a Messianic Jew either. So these are not my theologies. But it helps you to understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah. One of the really nice things about having you on is hearing you pronounce the words. So like, I love wisdom, knowledge, understanding. I read Proverbs every day. I'm trying to be a sage, trying to be a philosopher sage, right? But in my head, it's chokmah. So it's so good to hear you with not my Chicago accent. Can you pronounce it for us again?
Chokhmah.
It's so good.
Good.
This is fantastic. So
that would be the first of the Sefirah. And we actually see in the Kabbalistic tradition, the main protagonists in the Hebrew Bible are all embodiments of different, they are all incarnations of different Sefirot. So Abraham is an incarnation of loving kindness, and Isaac is an incarnation of restraint. Jacob, interestingly, is an incarnation of truth, even though he seems like an absolute liar, right?
Yeah, totally.
there's a whole. It's a very, very intricate system, and in fact, there were Christian Kabbalists in the medieval period who kind of played around with some of this stuff too.
Yeah. This is so good. Okay. So try not to get lost here. So there's some options for thinking about Sefirot. One is that the descriptions of one God, another is that they're, 10 names. And then another would be like their emanations, which emanate from God. And I would imagine that the emanation view might have more to do or might be influenced by like Neoplatonism, but perhaps
absolutely.
Not. Okay.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Okay. And Neoplatonism was a big influence over Jewish mysticism, just as it was over Christian and Muslim mysticism in the Middle Ages. And I actually think the emanations view is probably the most widespread.
Okay.
That these 10 things like emanations of one God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the, something that that I've noticed in, even in like the continental versus analytic debate, I would say the continentals are more the mystic like type brain folks. And, and even in Christian mysticism as well, when you try to get clear on some of this stuff, part of the impetus for it is that it's unclear. And that's part of the, like the mystic, like, hey, look, you're trying to get us to talk about this transcendent thing and I can't do that. So of course we'd expect. And it's like you try to pin down, well, what do you mean emanations? Is it, well, look, man, it's emanations. And I wonder, does that play a part in Jewish mysticism as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm doing, and a small number of colleagues, it's quite rare in that we're trying to use the tools of analytic philosophy to discuss not Jewish philosophy in general, which we do, but even to attack, so to speak, Jewish mysticism. And say, I know you guys are talking about things which are, in essence, difficult to talk about or whatever, and you also place a lot of weight not just on thought but on emotion and an experience, and that's great, and we're not criticizing that, but how much clarity can we bring to the ways you talk and to in the mystic tradition, and that's almost like a challenge I set myself, right? How much clarity can we bring to bear on these mystical traditions?
That's so good. So there's these three options, and then you come up with this fourth option, the Hasidic solution. But so I'm going to just go over really quick. Why are the first three, why are they no good?
Well, basically, if they are descriptions, if they're just 10 descriptions of God, then you have to lose a lot of what seems to be essential to the mystical tradition, because we talk about these things conflicting with one another, making love with one another, having relationships with one another. Well, you know, I'm sure, Parker, there are more than 10 true descriptions of you, right? We could come up with a whole list of true descriptions of you, but it would be really bizarre to talk about the descriptions fighting one another or making love with one another or producing things, you know, in anything but a deeply metaphorical sense.
Right.
So it just seems like description seems like the wrong, you know, the wrong way to go. Also, God is described quite explicitly in the Bible. I'm thinking of Exodus 32 and 33, where Moses is on Mount Sinai and he asks God for something like, "Let me see your glory." And God, so to speak, describes himself to Moses at that stage. Now, there's a deep dogma in Judaism that Moses is the greatest prophet who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And the idea that the Kabbalists could come up with 10 descriptions that beat the descriptions that Moses came up with. We can't accept that, right? So that's kind of an intra-religious kind of sentiment as to why it would be problematic to say descriptions. What exactly the difference between descriptions and names is, okay. But likewise with emanations, emanations comes closest to the view that I'm actually going to defend, right? I think the Hasidic view that I defend is almost like an unpacking of what we might mean by emanations. But until you unpack it, there's a difficulty in terms of the way that the Hasidim and the mystics talk about them being 10, but also one. Think of the three persons being three, but also one. If they're emanations, well, then there are 10 of them and they're not one at all. They're kind of emanations of the same thing, but the underlying, red and yellow are both refractions, I suppose, if that's the right word, of white light. But red is not identical to yellow. You know, they are different wavelengths. They're both there, perhaps, in the white, but they're not identical.
Yeah.
And if you want to say that these 10 things are, I wanted to provide a model that could really make sense of saying they're one and they're 10, without contradicting, without. And I think just saying they're emanations doesn't do that. Yeah. It's a little bit like you said, Parker. It's like in the mystical tradition, sometimes they'll give you a word like emanations, and you think you know what that word means, but like you haven't really been given a theory. Yeah. So just to say that they're emanations isn't enough. I think this is a little bit similar to what I believe in most Christian churches is thought of as a heresy, but the heresy of modalism in the Trinity, which is that there's one God and there's three different ways that he appears.
Yeah.
And the problem with modalism is that it doesn't give those three ways, first of all, enough ontological clout. They're merely ways that God appears.
Yeah.
And another problem, I think, with modalism for Trinitarians, but correct me if I'm wrong, is that it doesn't do justice to the sense in which God is all three of them. These are just masks that he wears. It doesn't really do justice to the unity between God and any given one of them. It's just masks.
Yeah.
So for similar reasons. For similar reasons why the Christian might reject modalism, I'm not happy with just saying they're emanations.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to me to do justice to the Kabbalistic tradition that I'm trying to make sense of, a tradition in which these 10 things are one, they interact with one another, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's really helpful. And I thought this was also fascinating for my Trinitarian listeners who emphasize the unity and diversity of Trinitarian doctrine and want to say like, hey, look, we have this problem in philosophy of the one and the many, and is everything one or is everything many? Well, kind of both. Well, yeah, that makes sense if the world has been made by a God who is both one and three. And I thought there's a nice little parody here of, well, here's a God who is one and 10. And so, it's a nice parody argument and it's something for Trinitarians to be thinking through. And so it's like, this is great. Guys, here's another one. Like, think through this too. It's really fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
So So I wanted to jump in now to the, so some people are going to be really interested in what we just talked about. And some are like, I'm just here for the idealism. Like, that's fine.
Okay,
here,
okay.
Here we go. So it's a Hasidic solution to the problem of Sefirot.
Of the Sefirot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you say, hey, look, maybe God's dreaming. Can you help us out? Yeah. Like, this is so good, man.
Yeah, well, and I'll be really controversial with you here, Parker. I'll up the ante. I'm not sure whether the Sefirot exists, right? It's sure. A theory of mystical Judaism. It's interesting. I'm interested in it. What could they possibly mean? I am quite committed to the idealism thing.
Ooh.
And what I was trying to do in this paper that you're citing, maybe you can post a link on it to it. Yeah. But what I was trying to do in that paper was say, look, you could use the idealism that the Hasidic movement championed, you could actually use it to solve the problem with the Sefirot. Now, I don't personally have a horse in this race because I'm not tremendously committed to the Sefirot existing or to taking it literally. Maybe not, I don't know. But I like the idealism thing. So yeah. I'll try and explain to you in a nutshell what the idealism thing is. I'm sorry that my emails keep...
no worries. Yeah, I can't even hear
pinging. So the way the idealism piece works is like this, and I actually wrote a paper with my partner in crime, Tyron Goldschmidt, with whom I've written quite a few pieces, and we wrote a piece called "Divine Contractions: Theism Gives Birth to Idealism." It's open access; people can find it on Religious Studies, the Cambridge University Press journal. So, Jewish mysticism. At least as it unfolds in the Hasidic tradition, as Tyron Goldschmidt and I understand it, is like idealism on steroids.
Yeah.
Okay. And I want to try and give your readers a sense of what would motivate this. Okay. Why should a theist adopt a really radical idealism? Yeah. And the basic picture goes something like this. Okay. We believe in God. Okay, this much we have in common, you and me, Parker, and I hope many of your listeners, right? We believe in God, and we think that God is perfect, and there may be a puzzle as to how can something perfect create a world like ours, and there are various ways into the puzzle. One way into the puzzle is that you could put it this way: God is so powerful that nothing he could create could, in some very important sense of the word, be beyond him, because he has such immediate power over over anything because of his omnipotence. Yeah. Tyron and I relate that power, that immediately efficacious power that God has. So right now, you have a fabulous moustache there, Parker. But right now, if God wanted that to disappear, it would disappear immediately. He wouldn't have to trouble himself with a razor. It would just disappear immediately.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of direct power from intention to result is the sort of power that characterizes the relationship between a mind and an idea. Of that mind,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't have that power over many things, right? You can't just like intend and then, right?
Yeah.
But you do have that power over your ideas, right? You can, conjure a red flower in your head and then you can say, I'm going to make it green. And then straight, you don't have to go out and buy any paint. It's just green immediately. It's green immediately. One of the arguments that Goldschmidt and I put forward is that God, because he's all powerful, he couldn't create something so far removed from his power that his powers would be anything different to the power that minds tend to have over their ideas.
Yeah.
So to speak, from God's position, anything that God could possibly create would just be a mind in his mind.
Yeah.
Or another way into the idealism is to think that, well, God is absolutely and utterly perfect, but there is no such thing as a perfect world. Now, part of perfection is that you would never create something suboptimal. Mm-hmm. The perfect God wouldn't create something suboptimal, but there is no optimal world. So God's in a bind and it looks like he can't create. So I've made two binds for God. The first bind is he can't create anything outside his mind. Mm-hmm. The second bind is he can't create anything that's suboptimal, but there's nothing that's perfect apart from him.
Yeah.
So he can't create. And there are different solutions to the problem. And there's actually a third problem. I won't get into a third way of putting the problem. There are different solutions to this problem, but the Hasidic understanding of the Kabbalistic solution to this problem is that God actually didn't create a world. He didn't create a world that exists outside of his mind. Instead, he imagined creating a world, and that's the most a perfect God could do. And that act of imagining brings into reality something like a fiction. And, you know, you and I, we live within this fiction. Now, it's a crazy view. It's a wacky view. You could come up with a million objections. I've tried to answer many of them in various places of my writings. But to really understand the view, I think this will give you the essence of it. You need to imagine reality as functioning all the time on two levels. Okay, mm-hmm. there is the world as it is from God's perspective, and there's the world as it is from our perspective.
Yeah,
and both of these are equally real in some sense of the word real, but one is obviously more fundamental. The world as it appears to God is more fundamental than the world as it appears to us. But they're both real in some sense. And what you have to do is whenever you describe some phenomenon, you have to tell me whether you're describing it relative to the world as it appears to us or relative to the world as it appears to God. And it's much like the distinction you have to make when talking about fictions in general.
Yeah.
So I could ask you, you know, is Hamlet a Danish prince? Well, you have to clarify. Do you mean in the story? And then the answer is yes. Do you mean outside of the story? I don't know, in the world of the actual writer called Shakespeare? No, Hamlet wasn't a Danish prince.
Yeah.
Does Hamlet have free will? Well, in the story, yes, he does. But relative to Shakespeare, no, he doesn't. Hamlet does whatever Shakespeare ordains for him to do. And finally, is Hamlet a figment in Shakespeare's imagination? Well, in the story, no, he's not. He's a person of real. He's a real person of flesh and blood. But, you know, from Shakespeare's perspective, yes, he's just a figment of Shakespeare's imagination. And we could say exactly the same things, mutatis mutandis, about us and our perspective and God and God's perspective. Yeah. That's the idealism piece.
It's like I have so much to ask because I wrote my master's thesis on the God-world relation as a authorial analogy. And so I'm like, oh, it's so good. There's so much. So, first and foremost, I want to,
C.S. Lewis, your main go-to.
He was one of them, but, I think the free will piece, he didn't think through as much. Mm. So he thought of it more as a tool for looking at particular, things like, well, why isn't God, how come the Russians can't go out into space and see God? Well, because he's not like that kind of thing. But then Kevin Van Hooser develops it for like everything. And I think that his model, it commits you to certain things. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, the notion of free will at play and stuff. But I want to anticipate an objection. So some people would say, well, look, let's go with perfect being theism and think through, you know, an idealist God who can only create in his mind versus one who can create outside of his mind. Yeah. Seems like the one outside of his mind is more powerful. And what you guys are doing is actually, you and Tyron seem like a similar move that's done when you think about the paradox of the stone. And it's like, look, is God limited? No. He's limited by his omnipotence.
His perfection.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so I think it's the same move, right?
That's exactly right. It's what we're saying is it's a consequence of his perfection that he can't create a world that's distinct from him or outside of him.
Yeah.
And actually, if you describe a God who can, you're describing a less perfect God.
Right.
It sounds paradoxical, but we think, you know, on careful scrutiny, that's actually how things unfold.
Yeah. It's similar to like George Mavrodes, I think that's how you say it.
I always call it Mavrodes, but I think you're right. It's Mavrodes.
I have no idea. But he says, look, it looks like under like careful scrutiny, it comes out to being like, hey, can God, you know, make a dog that's too big for a God who's perfectly capable of walking dogs? Can he do that? Well, no, he can't do that because you're asking him to be limited. So like what you guys are saying is when you spell it out, you're asking God to be less than perfect. You're asking him to be less than omnipotent.
Exactly.
So it's a really careful argument that if you want to critique it, you got to do the hard work of finding out exactly what's going on here.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Now, I think better critiques, and you've anticipated these in your comments, is, yeah, but on this view, you know, we wouldn't have free will. Yeah. And yeah. Surely we have that. We know we have that. And, yeah. and the problem of evil, you might think, becomes exacerbated.
Sure. Before we go there, I want to ask about the perfect world type stuff. So, probably planning us, maybe someone else, but there's like this objection to God creating a perfect world. And the objection is something like, there is no perfect world because you could always add one more thing. And so you guys might use that.
Bunny.
Exactly. Right. Planning always says hula girls, dancing hula girls. I'm like, that might be a little inappropriate.
That's a bit passe, right? You could get away talking that way, but it's not.
That's right.
Not appropriate.
That's right. Yeah. Dancing bunnies or whatever you said. And you guys might use that to say, look, because that's the case, there is no perfect world, or not might, this is what you guys say, there's no perfect world, so therefore a perfect being couldn't create, because otherwise he's creating less than. What if, following your own narrative theme, or like the theodramatic theme from Van Hooser, or you know, whatever we go with, what if he's not going for like the perfect world in balance of evil and good, but the perfect narrative, the perfect story, right? Yeah. What if that's like the impetus for creating a world outside of himself? What do you make of that one?
Good. So I like that. And I think that's actually part of the explanation is, you know, one of the classic theological questions is, why does God create a world at all?
Yeah.
And it's actually, on this view, it's a function of his kind of narrative brilliance, his artistic brilliance.
Yeah,
it's an aesthetic thing, right? Yeah. Why does a storyteller tell a story?
Yeah.
Now, so I like that, but I'd say this. I tried to explain that there are multiple problems, right? There's the problem of creating an optimal world. There's also problems to do with God's power. There's also problems to do with God's rationality. I won't get into it here, but we develop a similar problem from God's rationality. So I'd say, well, look, yeah, you might be right that God would have a reason to create a less than perfect world for kind of narratival purposes. But it might be that one of our other arguments will kick in and say, yeah, but still, that world can't be outside of him. It could at most be a story, with, so to speak, within his mind.
Yeah. Okay. That's really good. So I want to talk about evil real quick, and then we can go into like the free will stuff too. But
must eventually explain how this idealism could potentially solve the problem with the sphere art.
That's right. It's a good point. Thank you. I'm so excited about it. I'm having a hard time even like focusing. So would this commit you to like a privationist view of evil, because all evil then would exist in God, who is a perfect being?
Well, I actually think, when it gets to the problem of evil, this view has to offer two responses to the problem of evil.
Okay.
It has to respond from the point of view of God, the author, right? Why does God, so to speak, is telling a story, tell a story in which all these terrible, horrible things happen?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, from God's perspective, that's not so pressing, because from God's perspective, they're figments of his imagination, right? From God's perspective, the pain and suffering isn't real. There's still a question to ask. Why can't you tell a nicer story, God? Like, it's pretty horrible, some of these things you're imagining.
Right.
So it's still a problem, but that's one problem, and it needs its own response. But traditional theists, I won't say classical theists, but we theists in the Abrahamic traditions, we don't just believe that God is an author of the story. He's also a character in it.
Right.
And you don't need the Christian incarnation to believe that, because even, you know, even for Christians before the coming of Jesus, you know, God split the sea. God freed the Jews.
Of smoke. He's speaking out of bushes.
Like all that stuff. Exactly. Right. So God appears in the story. Now that happens in novels too. Novelists appear in their stories. Now but the thing is, what's true of the novelist and what's true as the novelist as a character in the story might be different.
Yeah.
Right. So for instance, you know, Kurt Vonnegut appears in The Breakfast of Champions. Mm-hmm. And in The Breakfast of Champions, it's true to say that he visited Kilgore Trout. That's true in the story, mm-hmm. but it's not true outside of the story because there's no such person as Kilgore Trout. Kilgore yeah. Trout is just a figment of Vonnegut's imagination. So too, we can talk about what's true of God in the story that he tells and what's true of God fundamentally, or, you know, yeah. from God's perspective. Now, in the story that God tells, God created the world, made us, and lets us suffer. So God, as a character in the story, owes us a theodicy. Why does the character called God do that? Right?
Yeah.
Now, I actually think any of the classical theodicies could be adopted here. You could yeah. give a free will defense. You could give a soul making defense. You could give any of them. So it's kind of interesting. It's on the level of God, the author, he's going to tell you one thing. And on the level of God, the character in the story, he'll tell you another.
Yeah.
If you go on to be super radical, you could say, well, actually, God, as he appears in the story, is not completely perfect. His complete and utter perfection is hidden from us in the story. And then the problem of evil disappears, right? I mean, that's very radical. And, yeah. you know, I don't yeah. want to be branded a heretic by my co-religionists, but right. But you could go that way. God yeah. is perfect beyond the story.
Yeah.
He says to Moses in that chapter in Exodus, no man can see my goodness and live. Mm-hmm. Kol tuvi, my entire goodness. It's almost like in order to give room for a world to exist, when God reveals himself to us as a character in the story, he doesn't reveal himself as a completely and utterly perfect character.
Yeah.
His perfection is at the transcendent level.
Yeah.
So that's evil.
Well, done. Oh, yeah, that's right. Everyone's done. No more. I just love this analogy so much because in the Christian tradition, I studied theology and I'm studying philosophy. And
yeah.
they're fighting in my own head, but they're also my friends and they come on the podcast and they fight too. And it's this analogy, at least from the authorial model, and it works the same with Hasidic idealism. Mm-hmm. You know, is God timeless or is he temporal? Well, which one are you talking about? Because the author exactly. stands outside of the story and yet he's a character yeah. in the story. And I'm an evangelical, so I have to use C.S. Lewis for mm-hmm. this stuff. But yeah. you know, you think of The Great Divorce. Lewis is yeah. a character in the story and yet he's talking yeah. with his characters. But meanwhile, Lewis is holding the whole story together in his mind.
In his head.
And yeah, insofar,
that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and insofar as the author yeah. Writes his own character, himself as a character, in a way yeah. that genuinely represents him, then yeah, you yeah. can trust that like C.S. Lewis is like this in
that's right.
space reality or, you know, in that's and of
right.
himself.
Right, like, that it's not yeah. deceptive.
Yeah.
It's not deceptive, but... You know, as sophisticated readers of fiction, we might recognize that, oh, in order to function as a character in this story, he had to become temporal or something.
Right.
Whereas perhaps in the transcendent space, you know, he's atemporal.
Yeah.
I try doggedly not to have a view on that, about whether yeah. God outside of the story is temporal or atemporal.
Well, it could be either, right? Yeah, it could be either. You yeah. don't know. But you think about C.S. Yeah. Lewis writing the story and the climax of the story is about to happen. And then pause. What's going on? Where's the climax? It's like, yeah. oh, Lewis.
I'm also going for tea.
Yeah, yeah. coffee. Yeah. And it's like, no, it doesn't actually pause because there's two different levels of time going
exactly.
on. Whether the you know God level actually has time or not, it's still different. Yeah. It's still a different time.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
so good. Yeah. Well, I think yeah. about.
No, it's a very powerful model.
Yeah, yeah, and it can bring a lot of people together, and a lot of people will say you're heretic. So that's maybe yes. you're onto something when that stuff happens. I'm wondering. Okay, here's a difference though. So yes, you need a theodicy. And I think if God's telling a story in his mind, or if he's telling a story up, you know, out there in the world, he would have a greater, if he's good, you know, he would have a morally sufficient reason for writing the evil into the story. Cool. That's all cool. I think one thing that I want to hear from you on is, if the story is outside of himself in an objective world, you know, going on, yeah, in creation, then like evil is out here. It's out mm-hmm. here in the story. But if it's all mm-hmm. in God's mind, then it seems like this perfect being has evil like in his head, unless we go with like a privationist.
At least that he can imagine evil.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Right?
So then you have a question, and I hate to use this terminology on your respectable podcast, but it wasn't my terminology. It's okay. Actually entered the learned canon. It's called, I almost can't bear to say it myself, but it's called the horny God objection.
Yeah. Did Mullins make that up? Did Mullins make that up, or was it someone else?
No. I think Mullins made it up, but I think he was actually riffing on the PhD dissertation of Tasia Scruton at Leeds.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I think Anastasia Scruton is the real source of this horny God objection.
Yeah.
The idea is some people think that related to what you were saying with Mavrodes and the rock that God can't pick up. There are certain paradoxes of God's perfection. Some people think that it's a function of God's perfection. There are certain things he couldn't imagine.
Right.
So he could, you know, he couldn't imagine evil things. He couldn't, and he couldn't have like horny thoughts is the reason it's given that, you know, it's not like, you know, if God sees an attractive person, I won't say male or female, but God sees an attractive person enter a room, he doesn't go, it doesn't, and it couldn't enter God's mind to think such a thing. Right. So I actually think I'm committed to the view, because otherwise I don't think I can explain at all evil in the world. I'm committed to the view that God can imagine evil things.
Yeah.
I don't think I need to take a stance on whether evil is just a privation or.
Okay.
I just don't think it's part of perfection not to be able to imagine bad things. On the contrary, I think we're talking about artistic perfection as well and aesthetic perfection. I think, you know, there are some people in aesthetics who want to condemn artists and authors for their ability to imagine very dark things.
Right.
I don't think that's fair. I actually think it's part of their aesthetic perfection that they can imagine those things. Mm. Perhaps even that they can see the beauty in them.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this one a lot because of the ethereal analogy, but it seems like there might be some kind of like aesthetic or ethical requirement. If you wrote a story that's only about like graphic child abuse and there's no redemptive qualities, you'd be like, hey man, this is really bad, you shouldn't write this, you know. That's not the case here, right?
Exactly. I think I would agree to that. God couldn't write a bad story, and whatever bad story means,
right?
And I agree with you, a story that was just unrelentingly evil and there didn't seem to be any point, that's something we can't believe God, even in his transcendence, would be able to do. But I do think God could imagine a world with holocausts and terrible, terrible things, so long as, you know, like Martin Luther King Jr. said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. If the story as a whole, you know, ends in redemption, then I don't see why God shouldn't be able to imagine even the most dire things.
Yeah. So I love this. I love this topic. I shouldn't say it's hard to say I love this topic, but it touches so much stuff in philosophy of religion, like Zagzebski's omnisubjectivity. Like, does God have our, you know, perspective? Well, what if I'm doing something evil? Okay, so that touches that. And then Graham Oppy calls it like the problem of body thoughts, which is a little bit of, you know, outdated term for a lot of us millennials and Gen Zers, but it's a problem of body thoughts for theistic conceptual realism. And it's like, okay, all this stuff connected, this is on the table for all of us. So it's really fun thinking through this.
Here's like a really weird question, right? But something I've thought about. There are certain experiences we can't really imagine having because we don't have the right sorts of bodies, right?
Yeah.
So I as a cis male, I can't really imagine giving birth, right? I can imagine being in pain. I can imagine being, but like certainly not with much authority, right? I can't imagine. Yeah. So, but here's the thing, right? Tolstoy writes Anna Karenina, the novel, and it's a female protagonist.
Yeah.
Is there anything that Anna Karenina knows what it feels like that Tolstoy doesn't know what it feels like?
Yeah, right.
Well, like, how could there be? Because like everything that to Anna Karenina, even it's all imagined by Tolstoy.
Yeah.
So I think it gives you, potentially it gives you a way to understand omnisubjectivity.
Yeah.
Even though God is so transcendent and other and doesn't have a body, and having bodies themselves was just an idea that God had.
I know. So, like, yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. and you might, if you're like really analytic into it, you might go with like conditional or something. God knows what it would be like. So it's like, does God know what it's like to eat a Chicago style hot dog? It's like, well, what do you mean? Like, what do you, does he know what it's like for me? Yeah. What does he know what it would be like if he were to incarnate? Yeah, he does. Yeah, of course.
But he doesn't know what it's like to eat one without having a body, because there's no such thing as that, right?
But I think it's a helpful clarification, because then it's not just like God's spirit. He can't do that. It's like, well, we can say more than that. We can absolutely say more than that. But yeah,
exactly.
I have to.
Yeah,
so
but when you understand that God created the concept of taste.
And hot dogs.
God created the concept. Yeah, and hot dogs, right? So,
Maybe
of course
I should
he knows what they taste like.
Yeah, kosher ones. You know, it would have
kosher
to be,
one, kosher ones.
Exactly. I have to say, because if Dr. Van Hooser is listening, his whole point in his authorial analogy is that God would have to be like a Dostoevsky instead of a Tolstoy, because he would say, like, depending on, you know, literary criticism or whatever, like Tolstoy is kind of right there wearing a mask behind his characters, whereas Dostoevsky's almost like come to life on their own, and they don't always represent the ideas of the character of the author himself. Yeah. So that's just a different point about, but I think there's something here with imagining. Okay, so this brings us on to free will. I would think that this would commit us to a form of compatibilism, but maybe not. Maybe not. And I've heard like maybe Molinism and maybe like a libertarian free will. I know like Hugh McCann in Creation and Sovereignty of God is kind of like a leeway compatibilist about stuff like this. So have you, what do you think? Is it broad enough, or is it committed just to compatibilism?
I wrote a paper years back. It's got many imperfections in, and I think the best parts of it exist in my book now called The Principles of Judaism. But in that paper, it's called God and His Imaginary Friends.
I love this one. I really like this one. Yeah.
Thank you, Parker. So I actually, I cite Hugh McCann there in a few places in that paper.
Okay.
And no, it's only in the footnotes, but I think it's only in the footnotes. But I relate to the issue of free will over there. And the model I put forward there is like libertarianism, is God imagines us into existence with our libertarian free will. And so you get this, again, you need to analyze our statements relative to one or other of the levels of this ontology I'm giving you that I'm calling Hasidic idealism. From God's perspective, it's true that everything we do is preordained, right? So that's like at best a compatibilist free will we have, right?
But
you're misreading the story of Hamlet if you keep saying, oh, why did Hamlet do that? Oh, because Shakespeare wanted him to. No, that's not part of the story. Shakespeare dreams Hamlet up as freely choosing to do things. And it might well be that libertarianism is part of what we really mean by freedom, in a thick sense of freedom.
Yeah.
So, and that I take very much from Hugh McCann. Says that pretty much explicitly.
Right.
The author, he uses the authorial analogy there, and he says an author imagines a character freely choosing, and it's the act of the author's imagination. Now, it's really hard for people to get their head around. You could almost call it like it's meta-compatibilism, because it's trying to make libertarianism compatible with a type of theological fatalism.
Yeah. So I read Hugh McCann's book, it's for the audience, Creation and the Sovereignty of God, and I read it for my master's thesis because I saw that he was using that. And it was so... Yeah. I just dropped it because I was like, look, I can't do this with the libertarianism. Maybe someone else can, and it looks like you have. But I was thinking like, well, it's just easier to use like reasons responsiveness or something like God.
Yeah, I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to myself because my younger self would hate this.
Yeah.
But I'm less and less committed to libertarianism.
Okay. Yeah.
I used to think it was super important, and
Well, it works super well. Yeah, and the other options work super well with the dream analogy or with the authorial narrative analogy, because at one level, why did Sméagol become Gollum? Well, because it was integral to the plot and
to the plot. It couldn't have happened any other way.
And Tolkien wrote that, and he wrote it from his office. And it wouldn't have been as good of a story. Yeah,
no,
right, yeah. But then you look intranarratively and you're like, why did he do it? Well, because he was jealous and he had his own reasons that he was drawn to. And he didn't feel Tolkien like, if Tolkien ex machina'd him and made him like totally different, like dropped in out of nowhere. He's a bad author. Yeah. And the story falls apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, okay. So what I tried to do in that paper was to say, you know, even libertarianism can kind of be salvaged, but I'm not as committed to the necessity of doing that anymore.
Yeah. So, Brian Ballard came on my show and we were talking about this cause he's working on like narrative realism and, He was saying maybe it's like a choose your own adventure story where it's like kind of like Molinism and there's a bunch of options. And so God wouldn't ever let it the libertarianism run amok and make it a bad story. He couldn't do that, but he's given, you know, all these different options. Yeah. And so you can choose how the story goes, perhaps.
So in some places I've called that weak Hasidic idealism.
Ah, nice.
Is the idea that somehow God has created the world with figments of his imagination, but somehow, because God is so much more powerful than any author we can imagine, his merely fictional creatures are actually agents.
Yeah.
And therefore they get to make choices or whatever. But I'm into the extreme Hasidic idealism, which is what I think Hasidic tradition, which is that actually, no, like... You know, we are agents. Of course, we're agents in the story, right?
Yes.
But you know, from God's perspective, it doesn't make sense to say that, you know, we could have made it go differently,
right?
There's lots more problems here, and I think a lot of your listeners will be like, "Why didn't Parker ask this problem or this problem?" Because there's only so much you can discuss in a certain time. But I would, you know, if people are interested, like you said, all these authors you've cited deal with the authorial analogy. Looks like you have in your own work, and in my Principles of Judaism, the book is in three parts, and in the first part, the Principles of Judaism, I really try to grapple with many of the problems your audience might have raised without without us getting to. So.
Yeah. There's a couple. Do you have a little bit more time? I can.
Yeah, we have to solve the problem, the sphere art.
That's right. real quick, before we do that, I know, okay, there's two things. One is just, does this commit us to like pluralists? Are we pluralists about being, like, are we Meinongians here? Yeah.
Great question, Parker. I don't think it makes us Meinongians, but I'm actually working on a paper with the brilliant Filippo Cassato. He's a philosopher at Lehigh. And he's tried to push me to recognize, and I think he's right, that Hasidic idealism cannot solve many of its own problems without a view called ontological pluralism, which is what you're pointing to. Ontological pluralism doesn't have to be confused with Meinongianism, because that's one particular type of ontological pluralism, right? Meinong thought that not everything that has being exists, so he thought there were kind of different species of existence. I think that what the Hasidic idealist might have to say is there are degrees of being, and that God has a higher degree of being than anything else, right? God, the author, has a higher degree of being than anything else. There are various reasons why I don't want to say that it's Meinongian, but they're technical. I agree with you. I think it will be hard to make sense of this view, but you being quicker than me, I didn't see that until recently. You know, I've published a lot on this topic and I didn't really get into issues of ontological pluralism.
Yeah. Well, this is so cool. And I think for like the hardcore Thomists out there who, you know, hold to like the analogia entis or something, it's similar to that. It doesn't have to be like some crazy Meinongianism. Even if it is, then just defend it. Who cares? But
yeah, Joshua, that's right.
Just stand behind it. But Joshua Siduate has been doing some of this with existential quantifiers and using different ones. And he's, you know, pulling in. Yeah. So I need to get all you guys together and we need to like work on
it. Most Thomists accept. And I think most scholastic medieval theologians from across the three Abrahamic traditions accept that there's a sense in which God's existence is different to ours. And that's you know, part of the problem that people would say to me when I first put this stuff forward. They want to say something like, "What are you saying? Like me and my freedom aren't real?" Yeah. I'm like, "No, you are real. You're as real as anything else in your environment. The only thing you're not as real as is God. And if you've got a problem with that, then that's, you know,
right.
we shouldn't, it's impious to think that we deserve to be on the same ontological level as God, right?
Totally.
You're as real as anything else.
Yeah. All right. Last one before we get back to panentheism. Is this a form of panentheism? So the world is in God, but God is more than the world. Yeah. You know, the world's in the mind of God.
Okay. It might be. It just depends how you define that term. Just,
especially tricky to demarcate, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, I don't think of ideas as being parts in a Mariological sense. I don't think of ideas as being parts of the minds that think them. Yeah. Some philosophers of mind do think that.
Right.
Right. So, yeah. So some philosophers of mind would say that every idea I have is a part of my mind.
Yeah.
I'm not attracted to that view. And the ontology I'm providing suggests that the world is to God what ideas are to minds.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm not saying that the world is part of God. And I take it that orthodox panentheism is the assertion that the world is part of God. Well, then, no, I'm not a panentheist.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're taking it with a pinch of salt, you're saying, no, it's a metaphor. It's part of God in some sense. I get why you might think you might want to call this panentheist. It's panentheistic in spirit.
Yes, yes, that's a good way to put it. And it, especially if you go in for like Brian Lefthouse's view on like abstract objects in God, where he's like a theistic conceptual nominalist, then these are God's thoughts, but they're all like a current, and he does it in a way where they're not like their own entities inside God's mind, and so you can still be like hold a simplicity. And it's so fascinating. Again, it's all connected. So for those who are thinking this is just like stoner thoughts, it's like, well, sure, maybe, but it's also philosophy of religion, like deep stuff.
Yeah. What I really want to do, I love what you said. Like, so it might not be my Meinongian, and if it is, so defend it. I love that attitude, Parker, because I think that the job of theistic philosophers, we're all theists, perhaps for slightly different reasons, our own life experience, our own, you know, whichever our favorite arguments might be for theism. Right. We're all, you know, we've come to theism. I think the responsible thing for theistic philosophers to do is say, okay, what are the consequences of this? And don't imagine that they won't be radical, because it's a radical thought, right? That there is a supreme being, and that everything else that exists exists in virtue of that being's activity or intentions, or, you know, any good theist will end up sounding like a stoner, because it's a crazy view.
Doesn't that just breathe the fire back into your faith too, though? It's like for whatever reason, God gets boring, and it's like, well, what? No, God is not boring. God is the most exciting thing you could ever think about.
Exactly.
Well, let's go back and see if we can solve this problem of safe route.
I'll do it for you in a second.
You're right. Yeah.
I'll try and do it for you really quickly, right? So we've already got all the ingredients here, and the basic idea is something like this. We said what's true of the author outside of the story and what's true of the author in the story can actually be different, even though they are numerically the same author, right?
Yeah.
So the words Kurt Vonnegut refer to one person. There's no two Kurt Vonneguts, there's one Kurt Vonnegut. But what's true of him in The Breakfast of Champions isn't identical to what's true of him outside of The Breakfast of Champions, even though there's only one of them.
Yeah.
So I want you to be able to imagine a strange story in which the author appears as more than one character, or one person, one real person appears as more than one character in a story.
Like David Hume's dialogues, right?
Yeah, well, that's a good example. But which one's Hume? Well, multiple protagonists are Hume. But here's an example I give people. I call it it's a story called Loving Lois. Okay, what I want you to do is you imagine that Lois Lane writes a story that's about Clark Kent and Superman.
Yeah,
but she doesn't know that they are the same person. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now it's about Clark Kent and it's about Superman. She doesn't know that they're the same person. And in the story, they fight over her. They, you know, Superman throws Clark Kent out of a window. Clark Kent, you know, goes and gets some kryptonite and tries to, you know, poison Superman because they're both madly in love with Lois Lane. It's her nighttime story writing, you know, fantasy writing. It seems to me that the right analysis of such a story is that in the story, Clark Kent and Superman are two people.
Yeah.
You would be misunderstanding the story if you thought they were one person, because one person can't hold them, you know, can't throw the other one out of the window, right? In the story, there are two people. And yet, because unbeknownst to Lois, in the real world, Clark Kent and Superman are the same person. Mm-hmm. And because unbeknownst to Lois, one of her characters is Clark Kent and one of her characters is Superman, but they're actually the same person.
Yeah.
I want to say that you get these really weird consequences. The consequence would be Clark Kent is identical to Superman outside of the story, mm-hmm. and non-identical inside the story. How many people are there?
Yeah.
How many people are there? Well, there are two, Superman and Clark Kent in the story, and there's one Superman who is Clark Kent outside of the story. And I wanted to imagine that even an author could do that too. An author could put themselves in a story as more than one person.
Yeah.
And the suggestion is that if you're committed for one reason or another to the Kabbalistic tradition, and you really believe there are these 10 sephirot and they really do interact in the ways that the Kabbalah says that they do, you could say, well, perhaps, you know, we're all characters in God's story, but these 10 are special. Because these 10 are God appearing as 10 characters.
Yeah.
And then it will be that in the story, they are non-identical. But outside of the story, they're all one.
Yeah.
And it's no more of a paradox than the loving Lois scenario. And I like it. I think, you know, if you do have reason to believe in the Sephirot, you can actually salvage almost everything the mystics say about the Sephirot now. Oh, they're 10 and they're one. You just have to be careful which level of reality they're speaking about, and you can get everything out you wanted to get out. And I wanted in the paper to suggest that maybe a Trinitarian could do the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, my friend and colleague, and he was my office mate for the year at Notre Dame, Karl Mosher, who's a really decent Protestant, theologian, great guy, evangelical as well, I think, and a really fabulous human being. He was like, no, this can't work for the Trinitarian, because he wants to say that it's of the essence of Trinitarianism that God is essentially triune.
Yeah.
So that would mean that somehow God, the author, has to be triune as well.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say, well, look, you could even go like this. You could even say, like, in the story, God is essentially triune, or something like that.
Yeah.
I would say that beyond the story, he's undifferentiated. But look, it's not my trying to save Trinitarianism is not my that's not my issue.
Yeah.
I just wanted to offer it to my Christian friends. I do think it works for the Sephirot.
Yeah.
I think it might work for Eastern Orthodoxy in their talk of these divine energies. Whether or not it works for the Trinity will be up to the Trinitarians to decide.
Yeah, and it might just take some tweaking of saying, like, it's God is a function. God is a functional person made up of three intrinsicist persons. You know, Chad McIntosh has done stuff like this, but I just want to make a point for the audience that we've gone all over the place, and we talked about Meinongenism, and now we're into Frege puzzles and hooded man cases.
Yes.
And
exactly.
just for those who like poo-poo philosophy of religion, like philosophy of religion is philosophy on hard mode, because we also have traditions that we're trying to hold to and
to be respectful of.
Yeah. To be respectful of others, to not be smote by God maybe too. Like,
it's
philosophy on hard mode. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is where philosophy in my mind is most alive.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I got one more. This is for like the public facing philosophy. I always try to I actually hate that phrase, because what in my mind, a lot of public facing philosophy is just, I have this really technical stuff. How do I, foist it onto the audience? I really think it should be like you take the questions that the popular audience has, the abstract thinkers who aren't philosophers, and you pull that in and you incorporate your work. So with that in mind, I wanted to ask about simulation hypothesis. And how this might relate, and how it might be different than, is it just the same thing? Is that a metaphor for this dream?
I think they're deeply, deeply similar. Okay. I have a paper, it's currently under review, let's hope it gets published one day, called We Live in a Story.
Yeah.
And I try to argue that in a nutshell, what Nick Bostrom argues for in his famous simulation paper is that there's a good chance that we live in a simulation. Right. That's what he tries to argue, right? Yeah. In interviews, he sometimes says it's 20%. Yeah, how you figure that out, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Right. Well, I have this argument where I try to prove that, you know, if there's a chance that we live in a simulation, then there's a much, much higher chance that we live in a story.
Yes.
And my idea is that stories are kind of a wider category than simulations.
Yeah.
That simulations are kind of stories, like a limited type of a story, and that stories are a wider, you know, and therefore it's overwhelmingly likely, I want to say, that, you know, if it's 20% likely we're in a simulation, I want to argue it's overwhelmingly likely that we live in a story, which just so happens to be a consequence of theism anyway.
Yes.
We shouldn't be surprised.
I love that so much. And I think even some theists will use the simulation hypothesis as a metaphor for God. And I'm like, hey, that's something. But the authorial analogy is much better because it actually has more implications. It's got more explanatory power. We got a necessary being instead of just some simulator. And I also think that the simulation hypothesis focuses so much on the furniture of the story. At the popular level, they'll talk about physics and rendering and computer games. It's like that's so like base level. Like the narrative arc of the story is much more, you know, that's who cares about the furniture on stage? Let's look at the characters and the plot.
I'm totally with you.
This is awesome.
And actually, God isn't limited by any of the things that might limit computational power of physical computers as well, right?
So
the base reality has certain limitations potentially, but God has none.
Right. Yeah. We can't talk about everything in the world, but maybe we got to get you back on. But for the audience, like some people will be reminded of Descartes' dream argument and say, well, that's a skeptical thesis. So maybe this isn't, this isn't a skeptical thesis. And
No. I think that's an important point to make, Parker.
Yeah. Another one would be like, hey, look, sure. Tolkien's not on the hook for what Smeagol does, or Gollum does in the books, but that's because they actually don't have a subjective perspective, whereas we do. And so God's still on the hook for evil here. And
it's exactly. Yeah. Especially God, the character in the story, he is on the hook, right? Yeah. And that's why theodicy is an important project.
And also
you're on the hook because in the story in which you live, you're the one who's made the decisions you've made, and therefore you're on the hook. A lot more to talk about.
Yes.
But I love your enthusiasm, Parker, and I hope that we've been able to spread some of that to your listeners.
I think so. Yeah, Sam, thanks so much for coming on to talk about your work. Thanks for the papers; they're amazing. I'm going to leave a link to your page with all your papers, and then I'll specifically put some of those in there. And looking forward to having you back on soon.
Me too, Parker. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
All right, folks, that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God. Hey, Sam.